Next, we have Paul Arbison discussing testing the bridges between science and Christian faith.
Good afternoon. I'm going to talk about my own experience over, I've been a member of ASA for a long time, my experience, my journey in looking at the bridges between science and Christian faith, which is what ASA is all about, right? So go ahead, start with this. I have always been interested in science since very early childhood. With my rock collection, my little toy microscope, I was so proud. I got this rock hammer. I was going around exploring my neighborhood. As I grew up in, as a freshman in college, I went to Virginia Tech, and I concluded that science explains everything. So therefore, God is superfluous. So I concluded I must be an atheist. However, as I widened my awareness of the world, I realized that science really didn't explain everything, particularly in terms of my own person. And so after a long series of Bible studies, I became a Christian. And then in 1976, I joined the ASA. And at that time, the editor of the journal was Richard Bute. And he had a big influence on my early Christian life. And one of the things that he often quoted is this idea, authentic science and authentic Christian faith. This is what we're after. So that really struck me that he was a Stanford professor of solid state physics, very prestigious position. He also ran a science and religion class there at Stanford at the time, and he was the editor of the ASA Journal. So I saw here's an example of a person who is really affirming these two things. But also I'm interested in this bridge between the two, and how do we build that bridge between these two things? I've been on a search, seeking this authenticity and this connection. 2 Corinthians 13:5 says, examine yourselves to see if you're holding to your faith. Test yourselves. And so this is good for us to be self-critical, and to test ourselves. Now, if you're going to San Francisco, you've got to cross two bridges. From Berkeley, Oakland, you go to Treasure Island, and then you can get over to San Francisco. There's two bridges. And that's kind of the way the ASA is placed. On the one hand, we are relating to those who reject mainstream science and support a literal biblical view of Genesis, things like that. On the other hand, we are connected with mainstream science, but people who don't believe in God or don't believe in the Bible. So we are in the overlap region between those two. We are on Treasure Island. But if you think about the San Francisco Bay Area, there's fault lines under this whole area, right? The geologists will tell me. There's the Hayward Fault and the San Andreas Fault, and they're kind of unstable. And so what I'm suggesting by that analogy is that there's a deeper fault line in our thinking beyond just the creation evolution controversy or anti-vaxxers or something like that. There's a deeper level of division. And just to give it one explanation for that, historian Alexander Quaré, in a book from the 1960s, he traced the fault line back to Newton. From the simple elements of space and time and mass, he was able to establish the principles, the mathematical principles of physics on which our modern civilization is based. And it became so successful in terms of engineering and construction and design and electronics and optics and hydraulics, and all these other fields, that it began to be expanded. The prestige of Newtonian classical science grew into to the point where it was starting to be applied to things like human behavior, psychology, sociology, and lots of other fields where it really didn't apply clearly. And that was kind of an illegitimate extension of his method. But Corre says, and I'm going to read a quote from his book. He says, "There is something for which Newton, or better to say, not Newton alone, but modern science in general, can still be made responsible. It is the splitting of our world in two. It did this by substituting for our world of quality and sense perception, the world in which we live and love and die, another world, the world of quantity, a reified geometry, a world in which, though there is a place for everything, there is no place for man. Thus, the world of science, the real world, became estranged and utterly divorced from the world of life, which science has been unable to explain. They are divided by an abyss. Two worlds. This means two truths, or no truth at all. This is the tragedy of the modern mind, which solved the riddle of the universe, but only to replace it by another riddle, the riddle of itself." So this fault line between theoretical science and personal life is the tragic dualism of our modern culture. And academic legitimacy and authority has been granted only to science. And so I'm asking, are we really in an age of science, like Institute on Religion in an Age of Science? Are, you know, so I'm going to just go through very quickly some tests of these bridges between science and faith that have been proposed in ASA and in the Christian community. And I'm going to ask these test questions. Is it authentic science? Is it authentic Christian faith? How strong is the bridge built between them? So this covers pretty much a lot of the ground of things that I've been hearing at ASA meetings for decades. First, of course, creationism. I was at the same school where Henry Morris was. He was a civil engineer professor, and he focused on hydraulics, which is like flood control systems and sewer systems. So you can kind of see how he got into flood geology. And he was a very concrete thinker. So this makes sense. You got it. So he, and Ken Ham has his Answers in Genesis now. But I concluded after starting with a little Christian study group there, got drawn into this discussion. So I went through this whole creationist period, and I basically concluded that this is not working, not really authentic science. In terms of faith, I noticed that they insist on saying creation is the foundation, but I recall that 1 Corinthians 3 says that Christ is the foundation. So I see that it has weaknesses both in science and faith. I won't pursue that too far here. Let's go into the next phase, which is intelligent design. And I think most, in terms of science, intelligent design is a lot more accepting of modern science, but maybe some scientists have concerns about whether it's got some of these interventions, this God of the gaps theology coming in that creates some problems. So I've been reading a book by Andrew Porter. He's not well known in ASA circles, but he wrote a little book called By the Waters of Naturalism, where he points out that even if you think of these gaps that God is coming in, and maybe not in some kind of mechanical way, but in some subtle way through quantum indeterminacy, through a Heisenberg's uncertainty, and somehow affecting a divine action in a way like this. And Andrew Porter calls that cause laundering because it's sneaky. You know, it's a way that God can intervene in the world without being detected. Andrew Porter points this out, and this is just this naturalism by other means, but it's still basically assuming that God is thought of as a designer and a mechanic intervening in various places in the world. So I saw that as a kind of a weak bridge. Now, way back in 1620, Francis Bacon in his New Organon wrote a series of aphorisms, and in aphorism 89, he goes through the whole critique of the science and faith issue. That aphorism has been published in Perspectives Journal. I encourage you to take a look at it. It's quite fascinating to come from 1620. A statement in there says this, others with more subtlety surmise and reflect that if second causes are unknown, everything can more readily be referred to the divine hand and rod, a point in which they think religion greatly concerned, which is in fact nothing else but to seek to gratify God with a lie. So he's pretty harsh on them. Process theology is an emerging field among a lot of the more liberal schools of thought in theology. And I've been hearing from several friends of mine in a discussion group advocating various kinds of process theology. And just to be very brief, I'll just simply say I just think it tends to favor the science very strongly, but it's pretty weak in terms of authentic faith, in terms of traditional creeds of the Christian faith. It's much stronger. So these bridges tend to be cantilevers. They emphasize one side strongly and not the other. And so I don't see a strong bridge being built here in any of these things. Hugh Ross earlier today talked about this idea of a three-tiered cosmology, and he pointed out that maybe this was really a myth that was mostly invented in the 19th century as a critique of the Bible, that really a lot of ancients believed that the world was round and so forth. But at any rate, they will object to things. Some of these process theologians don't like the idea we talk about heaven being up, because there's actually stars beneath us and above us. So it's this idea of a flat earth tends to filter into our thinking. But I don't think that's a serious objection, because Christians can take things as metaphors. We can understand that heaven, but locating heaven, we're using metaphorical language. I don't think that's a serious critique. Gary Driver mentioned metaphors in his talk, and then William Morris just mentioned metaphors in his talk. We're very commonly acquainted with metaphors. So I think we need to think about the antidotes to literalism. Here's two antidotes to this literalism that comes both from the conservative side and the liberal side. Hermeneutics, right? Hermeneutics. So metaphorical language, here's some examples of this, showing the importance of metaphor. Language is vitally metaphorical, Shelley. All thinking is metaphorical, Robert Frost. All our truth, or all but a few fragments, is won by metaphor. Literalness we cannot have, C.S. Lewis. And what therefore is truth? A mobile army of metaphors. Truths are illusions of which one has forgotten that they are illusions. To know is merely to work with one's favorite metaphors. What about Jesus? He used metaphors all the time. I am the door. I'm the vine. I'm the bread of life. You are the salt of the earth. You are the light of the world. Remember now Jesus' dialogue with Nicodemus, when he said, the winds blow where it pleases. You hear where you hear its effects. You see the trees blowing, but you can't tell where it came from or where it's going. So it is with everyone born of the Spirit. All right? And so this is a metaphor of divine action. It's pointless to search for natural causes for divine action. People, as image of God, we are already God detectors because we bear God's image. Layers of meaning. This is another antidote to literalism. And Greg Davidson, the author of this book, he's going to be coming up next. I'll give him a plug here. This is a major departure from concordism that tries to match the Genesis text to historical events. Davidson and Turner instead reveal the rich layers of meaning in Genesis. This is a new approach that helps us to escape the assumptions of naturalism and literalism. There's been a kind of a literary turn and an openness to the literary traditions of people like C.S. Lewis and so forth that will help us as scientists to get a broader understanding of the scriptures. Now, in the remaining time, I have suggestions, seven antidotes to naturalism, the kind of early naturalism that I had in my naive childhood. I probably don't have time to go over all of these, but I'll go through them quickly. First, transcendence. God is transcendent. Think of an analogy of the potter to the pot, or an author to her book, that relationship. It's the author transcends the characters in the book. Isaiah 55, God's ways are not our ways, and God's thoughts are not our thoughts. As the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, the Lord says. God is free, not dependent on anything. Creation, creatio ex nihilo, creation out of nothing by the word of God. The emphasis in Genesis is not on how things were done, but who did it. Right? And the focus is on the who. And then, of course, Isaiah talks about Isaiah 45. I did not create the world a void. I intended for it to be inhabited. Right? So there's a sense of purpose. God has a purpose in things. But transcendence humbles us. We want to be able to explain things and manipulate things. But divine action is just a mystery. You know, there are real mysteries in our doctrine. The Kant's critiques. Remember, in my freshman pre-Christian days, I joined the philosophy club, and one of the first things we studied was Kant's antinomies, where basically he proved that you can prove the existence of God, rational proofs. You can also prove the non-existence of God, rationally. And so what that leaves you with is a critique of pure reason, that reason alone is not sufficient to resolve that question. And it was great for me to discover that early on in my college career, to discover that principle. And so it leads us to this idea, there is a sufficient reason to believe in God, but not enough evidence to make such belief logically necessary or compelling. And likewise, there is sufficient reason to conclude that God does not exist, but not enough evidence to make that conclusion logically necessary or compelling. So, in either case, faith is necessary. Without faith, it is impossible to please God. It's helpful to distinguish between offensive and defensive apologetics. Offensive apologetics means building up some system, some rational arguments, rational system, data from science or something, to try to show evidence for God. And these tend to be rationalistic, naturalistic assumptions. Defensive apologetics simply requires you to tell your story of the gospel and the reason for the hope that is in you. So that's what Peter says here. Be prepared to give an answer to anyone who asks you to give you a reason for the hope that you have. It's you. It's about my story, right? That's what I think he's suggesting here. That's defensive apologetics. doesn't require you to set up your own philosophical apologetic. Multiple levels of reality. Now, of course, levels and layers are the kind of things we talked about in hermeneutics. Complementarity is a useful concept in building bridges. The left hand and the right hand support each other. The left brain, right brain. The female, the male. Each helps the other. By analogy, science and faith can help each other. So that's what ASA is all about. We bring together the science and the faith. And that can lead to a theology of nature rather than natural theology. I think what I've noticed throughout my life is that the key concepts in theology often come in pairs, such as, you know, God is one and many. We have a world of being and becoming. These basic themes, abstract themes, appear in all kinds of ways. Justification and sanctification. There's many of these kind of pairs of things. Truth appears to be dialogical, not monolithic. So when we seek to build these bridges, we're not trying to imperialize and dominate one by the other. We still maintain a dialogue between two sides. And finally, I am going to refer to a talk in 2019 by Jonathan Bryan, came to ASA. He's a science teacher from Florida, and he talked about the sacramental understanding of reality. He said the relation between science and faith may be approximated by the theological concept of the sacred or sacramental, in which otherwise natural phenomena participate in a reality that transcends them. So, for example, you can think of any object. Suppose, you know, you had two jars of salt, and one of them is, you know, they look the same, but one of them has been weighed to 5 decimal places, and the other one has not. So they're both the same material thing, but one of them has a transcendent additional meaning, you know? And it doesn't weigh anything. It's just an attached bit of information that you don't have on the other. There's a transcendence idea in everything like that. You have a name. I have a name. What is that? What does it weigh? How long, you know, how much time do I have left? So I'm suggesting that we should seek a bridge, but not at the expense of authenticity. Because the bridge builders that I've seen so far, when they try to build that bridge too strongly, it tends to become a cantilever, and it weakens the other side. So we are still in the dialogue mode, and maybe we'll always be in a dialogue mode. But that's good. That's okay. And even we think of the Trinity, even God is in relation as persons in dialogue. So I hope that, you know, these kind of ideas will help you in your own journey to know Christ better and to make him known. Thank you.
Questions? Thank you for the talk. I really appreciate that. If I'm hearing you correctly, correct me if I'm wrong, you're saying that we have a less literal, more metaphoric, more relational, dialogical understanding of Scripture. It'll help us to bridge the gap with science better. I'm asking, and this is my question to you, what if we have a more metaphorical, less literal reading of science? Because in the philosophy of science, that's the discussion right now. If you have a semantic view of theories, then you have empirical adequacy without reference or representation. So a non-realist understanding of science keeps science intact, but makes it a little bit more metaphoric, less literal. And it also makes sense of scientific progress, because something that's literally true cannot be added to. So progress, precision, all the scientific theories, mathematical entities, we can see them as progressive and see them as less literal, more metaphoric, and that might help to bridge the gap. And I think the more literal representational, a realistic view was a product of maybe the Enlightenment or became more nuanced during the Enlightenment. And sometimes we as Christians have bought into that philosophical problem and brought it into scientific practice. And I would just love your response.
Thank you. Yeah. Right. Well, metaphors are inescapable, even in science. If we talk about particle physics, you know, what's a particle?
Right.
It's a metaphor for a billiard ball or something that we see that's at our own scale, right? What's a wave? You know, it's a metaphor for something that we see and it's splashing in the pool when we were a kid, right? Neither of those is really what the physics is talking about, but they're metaphors, so you can't escape them. But we can use them. You know, mathematics helps us to discipline the way we talk about them. And Newton started that.
Okay. Can you get from one more question?
One more. Yeah. Lessing developed the idea of a gap of rationality. That went in one direction to existential thoughts and a leap of faith, and now we try to build bridges. And I think there's one guy who's either built a bridge or actually filled the gap. And I don't hear him about bridge building much, and I wonder why. And that's Gerald Schroeder, who wrote the book, The Science of God. And being a nuclear physicist, he had a formula, and something I'd never seen to do before. He took one formula with data from the science side for the age of 13.8 billion years, based on redshift, he actually developed that age without Hubble's constant. And then on the Bible side, he used Genesis days 1-6 as real numerical data to put in there to slice up all that time and see if what we see in natural science on the natural science side matched the creation side. And it matches really well. But then we have scholars saying, well, no, this is a, it's not a how, but a who. Yet Gerald Schroeder is saying this is a what and a how. And he had the best-selling book, New York Times bestseller for the year it came out. Usually science books get knocked off in 2 weeks from our team. So I'm just sort of wondering what happened.
Yeah, well, I haven't read Schroeder's book. He's a Jewish that sounds like concordism.
It's not.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not?
No.
Okay. So I haven't read that book.
Okay.
I put up my own list of books here, which I would recommend. That's one of the books that are on my list.
All right, well, thank you, Paul.
Okay.